Hello, my name is Leroy Chatfield, Director of the Farmworker Movement Documentation Project. This is another in a series of interviews about Cesar Chavez and his farmworker movement. My guests today are filmmakers Ray Tejas and Rick Tejada Flores, founders of Paradigm Productions, headquartered in Berkeley, California. In 1996, Paradigm Productions produced and directed The Fight in the Fields, a feature documentary about Cesar Chavez and the farmworker movement, which aired nationally on PBS. Our interview today may be found on the website of the Documentation Project at www.farmworkermovement.us in the oral history section. To begin today's interview, I would like to ask each of our guests to give us their name, tell us something about who they are, their educational background, their filmmaking experiences, and professional credits and awards they may have won. Ray Tejas, let us start with you.
Hi, it's Ray Tejas, and I was born and raised in Los Angeles, California. And basically, my introduction to Cesar and the farmworkers movement was through my father, who was he and my uncles were both electricians, IBEW. And my first encounter with the farmworkers was in the early '60s when they went and were actually helping, I guess, set up some dental clinics in up in Delano in that area. And I was at that time about 13, 14 years of age, so that was my introduction to the farm workers, and I didn't really get a sense of what was going on at that time. I just knew that they were helping out some folks who needed some help, and there was this guy named Cesar Chavez who was, you know, organizing farm workers. And at that time, I only went up once briefly and didn't really get a sense until much later on of what was going on with the farm workers. My educational background is I have a degree in literature and in English and Spanish, and then later on I went back to get a master's in Spanish and an MFA in film, and then went to work for Spanish language TV, eventually PBS, and that's while at PBS, while at KQED, did several reports on Cesar and the farm workers, and that's how I was reintroduced to the farm workers. So that's my story.
And where did you get your degrees, Ray?
I was at UCLA. I got my filmmaking degree at UCLA, and basically, it was I went back because I wanted I had friends who were making films, and they were having a lot more fun than I was working at the university, and also kind of reconciled this idea of teaching and doing, you know, positive work and reaching a lot of people through film. I realized the power of film and television, and that's what kind of led me back.
Okay, what kind of professional credits do you have? Give us some lists.
Well, Rick and I did The Fight in the Field together, so we have that film together, as well as Race to the Place, which are national PBS credits. But I also worked at ABC and NBC and did some national shows for them, for Dateline, etc. Also have worked with Discovery and National Geographic, and have done national shows for them over the last few years. But at this time, I'm working on a film on the Mexican Revolution, a two-hour national film for PBS. So,
what is the subject of the film?
It's called The Storm That Swept Mexico, and it's a look at the Mexican Revolution and its legacy, it's the Mexican Revolution of 1910-1920. So it's a historical film, but it also kind of reveals I'm hoping it'll help folks understand the relationship of the intertwined relationship between the U.S. and Mexico. So,
how many years of filmmaking experience do you count under your belt?
Probably about 30 by now.
30 years.
I've forgotten.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Rick, what about you? Start with your name and tell us something about who you are and your background, etc.
My name is Rick Tejada Flores. I grew up in Pasadena, California. Went to school at UC Berkeley, and then later to the San Francisco Art Institute, where I was a fine artist. I got a degree in graphics. I was also a photographer, but not a commercial photographer, a serious amateur photographer. I was hired by KQED in 1969 to work on a news show, and it was an apprentice program, and I learned basic filmmaking skills from there. So I've never studied filmmaking. From there, I went into work for ABC in San Francisco as a news film editor. Then I went to Los Angeles, and from there I went to work for the Farmworkers Union as a photographer and filmmaker from 1970 to 1972. Following that, I went back to Los Angeles, worked as a freelancer. Then I was a production supervisor and unit manager at KNBC in Burbank, the NBC home station. After that, I went back to PBS. I'd started in PBS. I went to KCET, the PBS station in Los Angeles, where I ran a national program series called Presente, which was organized by a group called the Latino Consortium. Around 1980, I left television stations and I went to work as a freelancer, and I've been pretty much a freelancer ever since. I've had a few stints at public radio and TV stations, but I've worked independently since 1980. That's the last 29 years.
And what about your credits and any awards?
Well, most of my credits, as such, didn't come during my experiences with TV stations, although I was listed as the coordinating producer on the Presente series for 2.5 years at KCET. I worked mostly for PBS. I produced a film called Low and Slow, The Art of Low Lighting, which aired as a special. Then I produced a film on Diego Rivera called Rivera in America, which aired on the American Masters series. I worked for a year at Blackside, the company that did the Eyes on the Prize series on the Civil Rights Movement. I worked on a series called The Great Depression. Then I had a series of films for the National Museum of American History on New Mexico history and culture. And then, from then on, most of my work has been in collaboration with Ray and Paradigm. As you mentioned, we produced The Fight in the Fields. We produced another show called Race to the Place. Also under Paradigm, I produced two other shows. I did two artist profiles for American Masters. The second was Jasper Johns, the modern artist. Then at Paradigm, I did a third show for American Masters with Lori Coyle, which is called Orozco, Man of Fire, on Jose Clemente Orozco. And I also did a show with Judy Ehrlich on pacifists during World War II, which is called The Good War and Those Who Refused to Fight Them. Most of these films have won some national awards. I don't really have the list of awards, but most of them have received some recognition.
So do you count about 30 years' experience in the filmmaking business?
Actually, I count 40, because my first job was 1969, and we're doing this interview in 2009. So
Just about 40 years. So on the line, then, we have more than 70 years of the filmmaking experience. Does that sound about right?
Yeah, that sounds about right. A lifetime.
A lifetime, yes. A couple of lifetimes.
Yeah.
My next question is, and you've already touched on it a little bit in your first responses, but let's revisit it again. Prior to your filmmaking work in The Fight in the Fields, which of course was about Cesar Chavez and the farmworker movement, what kind of personal involvement or contact did you have with Cesar Chavez and his movement prior to that film, The Fight in the Fields? Rick, what about you? You mentioned some of your experience with the farm workers. Would you be more specific, please?
Sure. Well, I first had contact with the movement in the late 60s while the Great Boycott was still on, because there were people assigned to the Berkeley Boycott who I met regularly in front of the Berkeley stores, the co-op markets, and I developed a friendship with them. I remember a couple of old Filipinos. I don't remember their names at this point, but I decided they were really great people, and I decided to support the cause, although I wasn't directly involved. Then a little while later, I was waiting for a teaching job And the teaching job had been promised to me 6 months in advance, and my partner, Gayan Fiedinghoff, and I said, well, let's go to work for the farm workers for 6 months. Let's spend some time on the boycott. We applied to work on the boycott in Los Angeles. And we never actually worked at the boycott. Our applications were forwarded to the union headquarters at La Paz in Keene, California. And Caesar, or someone called us, I don't think Caesar called us, but someone, I think it was Caesar's aide, Andy Alcaldu at that time, called us and asked us to come and work at the union headquarters because they saw that we both had photography skills and film skills. So I believe, I'm trying to think, early in 72 was when this happened. We went to La Paz, and we did some work on the union newspaper, El Malcriado. We were both photographers. And then, I believe in the summer of 72, I'm not sure on the dates, Caesar was in Arizona. The union was trying to prevent the passage of a very anti-labor law that would basically stop the union from organizing in Arizona. And Caesar decided to go on a fast. This was his second fast. And a few days into the fast, I got a call from someone, I believe it was Leroy Chatfield, who said, we need some people to come and help out here, just general stuff. Could you and Gann come to Arizona? So we got to Arizona sometime, I'd say the fifth or seventh day of the fast. And, you know, we went around and talked to people. We swept the floor. We just did whatever had to be done. And a few days later, we were talking to Caesar, and he said, you know, it'd be a great idea to make a film of this. Do you think we could do that? And he said, yeah, we could do that. So we flew back to L.A., picked up some film equipment for some really friendly people who would lend us the equipment, and came back and shot a film on the rest of this fast. And this fast had not been Caesar's first fast, but it's really significant because it's the fast from which the slogan, Si Se Puede, came. So the film was called Si Se Puede. So that was 72. And I believe Gann and I stayed on with the union for 2 years. We were there in 72 and 73, and then at the end of, you know, that period we had left, but those relationships that we had formed during those 2 years were very, very important to us. And so from then on, we sort of felt we were part of the farm worker movement family.
Mm-hmm.
In 1975, when you, Leroy Chatfield, were working for Jerry Brown, and the effort was made to get a farm labor law in California, we came up to Sacramento and did a little work helping support that effort. So that was the last direct contact I had until later on when Ray and I said, you know, this is a story we've both been affected on, and it was important to our generation, but the next generation doesn't really know about it. And that was why we decided it was really important to make the film The Fight in the Fields. And one last comment about The Fight in the Fields, which I think is very significant. We tried to start it around 1989. We worked for 3 years to try and raise the money for it. We could not raise the money for it. We were about to give up when something very sad happened. Caesar died. And the minute he died, people gave us money. So that was, you know, Caesar died in 1993, and we started the film in the end of 94. And we were about to give up otherwise. We couldn't have made the film.
Mm-hmm.
That's sort of a brief history of my involvement with the farm workers.
Okay. And Ray, let's turn to you. You talked about, because of your father being a union person with the IBEW, and you had some contact there.
Yeah.
What about after that? I mean, did you have any additional contact?
Well, no, not in direct contact, but basically, you know, I was involved with the with anti-war movement and Chicano movement through the 70s, and of course that was all part of it. So, but there was no direct contact. It was basically, you know, we were supporting the UFW, you know, as students and as activists. But it wasn't until the 80s, when I was at KQED, that I had direct contact with the union. And at that point, we did several programs. Basically, the big deal at that point was pesticides. And also there was, you may recall, these cancer clusters in McFarland, mm-hmm. in that area and through the valley. So we did several reports on the issue of the cancer clusters and pesticides and effect of pesticides on farm workers and consumers. So that's when I was back and went and interviewed Caesar and spent time in La Paz during that period of time. And then
now,
out of that.
That would have been in the mid-'80s then.
That was the mid-'80s, yeah.
Yeah.
And so we were, you know, there was a lot of interest at that particular time, and then there was actually the farm workers actually developed a film out of some of the footage that we had shot called The Wrath of Grapes.
Mm-hmm.
Is a deal that was made between KQED. It got a little sticky. KQED had sold the union some footage, and then the growers came back with another film, kind of a counterpunch to that. Which caused a bit of a stir where they actually, I believe, took some of the footage that KQED had illegally, I believe, and started up a whole brouhaha with, you know, battling the effectiveness of The Wrath of Grapes. So there was, you know, there was a lot going on there, particularly in around the pesticides issue, and KQED was pretty active in that, and that was my reintroduction to the farm workers, and actually, you know, had reestablished some contacts with some of the folks. And then Rick and I hooked up, like you said, in the late 80s and tried to get this film off the ground.
Mm-hmm.
But we went to the National Endowment for the Humanities 3 times with the project, and I thought there was some interest there, but like Rick said, until Caesar died, then once he died, he was history, I guess.
Right.
We're not supposed to jump in, but let me tell you something else about making the film. We were in contact with a major PBS series at the time. I'm not going to say the name of the series, but it was a series which appropriately should have been interested in the farm worker story, and especially Caesar's story, because they did biographies. And what we heard from them was they wanted a biography of Caesar if it was extremely critical.
Right.
And we said, no, it's not a bad story, it's a good story. And we're not going to tell it that way. So at that point, we went ahead and did it on our own.
Mm-hmm.
Right, and at that point, just to follow up on Rick's point, you know, most of the public, what they knew of the farm workers was a piece that was done on 60 Minutes, and an article came out in The Nation, which was really highly critical of Caesar, and those were the two major pieces that people knew anything about. So that was the impression, kind of, even with among progressives, the underlying impression of where the union was at. And Rick and I thought dig a little deeper and kind of clarify what was going on. But every time we mentioned the film, the question was, well, how are you going to deal with all this negative stuff? And we were saying, well, let's take a look at the farm workers movement and Caesar as a whole. Let's take a look at the big picture, and that's what we did.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about your decision to make the film in the late 80s, or your desire to make the film about Caesar Chavez and the farm worker movement. What was your thinking about, I mean, what were you hoping to accomplish by choosing this subject? Rick, how would you start the conversation?
Well, as Ray said, he was involved in the Chicano movement, and so was I. And we sort of, when we discussed the matter, when we were talking about making a film like that, we had the sense, and I think there's a clear consensus now, that the whole history, or most of the history of Chicano activism that came from that period stemmed from the farm worker experience in a couple of different ways. One was that the farm workers had proved that poor people could change their lives, and specifically, you know, Latinos were not a big part of the black civil rights movement at all. There was some connection, but not a lot. You know, but there had been the example of the black civil rights movement, and Caesar said, we can do things too, and he did them. So one was an inspiration for Chicanos, students, activists, workers. You know, it had this incredible effect to energize the community. The other reason was, another important reason was that apart from what the farm workers had done, there was this other really important issue, was that there had been thousands, or hundreds, maybe not thousands, of people who had worked directly with the UFW and learned how to do that, how to organize people, how to promote change. And those people went on to do other things. And so we just felt this was an incredibly important story that people were forgetting or taking for granted. And so we thought, you know, since it had this resonance, since it had led to so many things, both in terms of proving that Chicanos could, you know, take power and change things, and also training this generation of activists who went on to do wonderful things everywhere else, we thought it was just a very important story to tell.
And Ray, what is your what was your thinking?
Well, I think I agree totally with Rick. One of the things is that we felt that this was an important part of American history that had not been told. I mean, this finally, I think the National Endowment for the Humanities and the Independent Television Service, two great institutions, finally woke up and said, "Yeah, this is an important part of history, and these are the guys that should be telling it." But there's, you know, we kind of felt this was one of the major Latino leaders of the 20th century. Few people knew very much about what he had done, other than reading a few articles and seeing a few TV programs about Caesar. And you know, we ended up doing what we feel is probably the definitive work on until now on Caesar, which was a 2-hour film. And I think now, you know, looking back on it, people realize this is a real important guy that people had to know about. And there's lots of little stories out there. Rick and I just were firmly convinced. Actually, we had intended to do a series, a 6-part series on Latino history. And when we realized that we weren't going to get the 6-part series funded, we decided what is the most important story to tell. And we felt that it was Cesar Chavez and the farm workers. And I think we did the right thing by focusing on that story at that time.
Okay, let's talk about the making of the fight in the fields itself. Give us some details of the filmmaking work as it relates to the making of this film. I mean, from start to the finish, what is involved? What period of time does it take? And what about after the film is released? Rick, why don't you start the conversation?
Well, this was a major project. You know, I can't speak for Ray, but this was the most complicated, most involved film I've ever done.
I agree.
I'll ever do in the future. There'll be this. So it took a tremendous amount of work. You know, even though Ray had worked with the farm workers and had contact with them, even though I'd been on staff for 2 years, there was a lot that we didn't know. And there were many, you know, that history is sort of multifaceted. It wasn't just what we knew. It was looking at all the other people's experiences and putting it together. So there was a tremendous ramp-up project, you know, at least 6 months, maybe longer, where we did preliminary interviews, we talked to people. And, you know, the other really critical part when you're making films is films has to do with pictures. So we did it. We and Laurie Coyle, who was the main researcher for the project, we spent roughly a year looking for material, photographs, films, banners, posters, anything we could. And, you know, the nice thing about that was, the good side was that the farm workers movement had been very well documented, because during several phases, they really caught the American attention. And so there was a lot of material. The real issue was finding it. And it wasn't just American networks here. We got films from Italy, from the United Kingdom, from all over the world, you know, because it wasn't, at a certain point, it wasn't just a national story. It was really something important happening in this country that everyone else wanted to know about. So that was the beginning. You know, then the next step is actually going out and doing interviews, preparing for the interviews, finding people, tracking them down. In some cases, you know, the most difficult interview to arrange was the widow of Bobby Kennedy, Ethel Kennedy. It took over a year, maybe 2 years, before she felt comfortable doing the interview. So then you do the interviews, you have the archival material, then you prepare for the edit, you log and keep track of everything, because we had thousands of different things, probably 50 or 60 interviews. And then it's a very long process of trying to find the right way to tell the story. And you know, we had so much material. The issue in filmmaking is always you don't just get what you need, because when you're starting out, you don't know exactly what you do need. And the other thing, too, that made it such a long experience was that this was an important moment in history. This was when Caesar had just passed away. And so everyone was very reflective. And so on one level, we wanted to do a very good film. On the other level, we thought this was a really important moment. So, you know, many of our interviews were much longer than we would have needed for the film, because we thought it was a really good time to document. You know, people were thinking back. They were very reflective. And so, you know, we're trying to make a historical record as well as as well as just what we needed for the film. You know, and then there's, you know, the editing process is many different iterations. I think we went through, I can't remember, 9 or 10 different cuts of the film, at least 9 or 10 cuts. You know, we had advisors that we worked with, scholars. We had funders that we showed it to. And so it was a very laborious project getting to the end of the thing. You know, the preparing took a year. The shooting and editing probably took another year, a year and a half at least, to finish.
When we first did the first assembly, which means that we strung out the pieces that we thought were going to make it into the film, that we were, you know, and this is not entire interviews. The first cut was 8 hours long. So then we figured, okay, how do we chop it down from here? And then we chopped it down to probably about 3.5 hours, and then and really eliminating stuff that we felt, well, this isn't essential. And then we worked up from the 3 hour. 3.5 hours down, and we'll look down at 2 hours. But it was. I mean, we had an abundance of material, but it was hard making decisions. And I think the dilemma, and Rick, maybe I hope you'll agree with me, was basically how do we do a film which is a biography of a man and the history of a movement. And that was a tough part, is, you know, bringing together those two stories.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because. Just because Caesar had this symbolic value, people who screened the film, who looked at it, who advised us, in a way that, you know, history, unfortunately, is the history of great people. And so, you know, we were always pushed to talk more about Caesar. But we had to balance that because, you know, Caesar inspired the movement and symbolized it, but he didn't do the work. You know, I mean, he did a lot of the work at the beginning, but, you know, but he inspired all these other people, so it had to be their story as well. It couldn't just be Caesar's story. You know, so there was that balance we were looking for between all the ordinary people who had participated and this person who inspired them.
Mm-hmm. How many years total would you, from beginning to end, and the end being even after... I mean, what happens after you issue the film? The work is it over at that point, or
no? Just to begin with, I think from the time we started raising the money until we've actually completed the film, that was about 7 years. Mm-hmm. We spent 5.5 years raising the money, and about a year and a half actually in production, as I recall. And then there was the whole matter of getting it into on the air. I mean, we were fortunate that we got it to Sundance, and that, you know, got a bit of attention. But then we had to deal with getting it on the air, and we were lucky, I think, and I think it had to do with what we already had somewhat of a track record to be able to get it on as a special.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, we got some decent publicity, and the show did pretty well, even though it wasn't part of a strand. And which I think right now, Next to Impossible to get shows on is one-offs. Rick, I don't know what.
Yeah, it's very, very difficult now.
Yeah,
but when you're trying to reach people, the PBS broadcast is a good way to start the process, but it's really only the beginning because, you know,
right.
I doubt if we'd meet many people now who saw the broadcast in 1997, you know, even if they did, there's a whole other generation who didn't. So, you know, we felt that the real value of the film would be what happened after the broadcast, to get it into schools, to get it to labor unions, community organizations, libraries, because then it would have a lasting presence. You know, people would keep on coming back to it, you know, and then you have to develop supporting materials. We did a website. We did a teacher's guide so that, you know, teachers who wanted to teach about Cesar Chavez would understand the story well enough to work with their students. So there's this whole after-broadcast life, which is extremely important. And mm-hmm. The problem is, you know, people have different skill sets. You know, we're pretty good filmmakers, but we're not pretty good distributors and outreach people. So, you know, we had other people who helped us, who wrote the curriculum and stuff like that. But, you know, the real issue is, you know, it's not. We don't think this is a movie that's really going to go out of style or lose its importance, because we think, you know, that experience will always be an important experience. So, you know, the issue is to try and find ways so that people who hadn't seen the broadcast would still experience the film and learn from it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, what's interesting, I haven't checked recently, but we had a website on PBS for the film for many years, and the statistics were that of all the different information that people wanted, the teacher's guide was the most important. There were thousands and thousands of teachers and students who downloaded the teacher's guide as a way of really working with the film, and that was really gratifying.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So did the film, I mean, we're talking a minimum of 10 years when I hear you talk about from starting to raise the money to the aftermath of the publication or the release of the film, you're talking about a good 10, 12 years.
Right.
Does that sound about right?
Yeah.
At least 10, I'd say, at least 10. You know, and so when you're considering doing a project that's an important project, one of the factors is, do I want to devote that much time in my life to it? You know, and we really both felt it was extremely important to save the story. To, you know, I mean, the other issue that comes up with these things is, it's much, you know, you get a different story if people come in who don't know the story and try and figure it out. And, you know, the nice thing was that we had lived the story in different ways and we knew it. And so we were in pretty good shape to capture it. You know, and the other thing is, you know, that we were afraid, you know, like the critical articles on Caesar, we were afraid that would be people's reaction, you know, that it's important for people to tell their own stories. And that's why we did these long interviews, so that the people involved could actually say what it meant to them. You know, someone else can view it and say, well, I think they were wrong or right, but, you know, but you can't disregard the fact that they were telling their own story.
Right, and I think that, as Rick mentioned, the timing was important because people were at this point, you know, if you talk to Marshall Gans or Jerry Cohen, some of these folks who were intimately involved, they're at a point where they were very reflective about, you know, about their work at the union and the way that the union had dealt with them, and when you're able to do these long interviews or these interviews were basically the reflective interviews, you get a lot out of them. And we sat down with each one of these folks for at least a couple of hours on camera after we'd had in-depth discussions with them and really, really probed, you know, what they were thinking, what they were feeling. So they were pretty in-depth, pretty sincere interviews. So this, you know, doing this kind of documentary is not, you know, you can't be superficial. It's not a news report. You know, I think that folks were, saw that this was a moment to tell their story. And I think people were very, very, you know, forthcoming, and we were very, very gratified by the stories that we got. One of the things that is always frustrating as a filmmaker is that you only get part of, you know, you get a bit of folks' stories in the film. You know, you so very little. So, you know, we're always, you know, anytime we can use the material in any other way, when, you know, we can tell this, you know, get the story out there, like to different sites and different scholars that are working with material. I mean, it's always gratifying that the material gets used anew.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm pleased that you've done this series of interviews, and hopefully, your site will live on for many years.
Right, right. Yes, all of your interviews have been published on the website of the Farmworker Movement Documentation Project in the oral history section.
Yeah.
Any regrets either of you about the 10 years that you spent on this project? Any second thoughts?
Not. I don't. I mean,
you always say, well, would have been nice if it had only taken 9 or 8.
We made a little bit of money out of it to pay our bills.
We never paid our bills on the film. You know, because we cared so much about it, you know, we said, well, that's how much we have, but we're going to spend another 6 months just because it's important.
It's
unfortunate it took 10 years, but I'd do it again.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. This is about the most gratifying project I've ever done. So,
well, let's sort of step back now from talking about the nitty-gritty and the details and the years and how much time it takes and all, and let's look at the bigger picture if we can for a minute. From all of your research, we're talking about 10 years, your interviews, your shooting, your editing, the work that you did afterwards, developing the audience. What general impressions or conclusions or observations have you formed about the farm worker movement? Ray, what about you?
I just think that the impact of the farm worker movement is still being felt. I mean, the folks who came out of the movement and the training that they got are off, you know, organizing and doing all kinds of other work. And I think that, you know, the inspiration that and hope that the farm worker movement gave to a lot of folks who felt powerless prior to that, I mean, I think that that's reverberating through society today. I think that, you know, whether people recognize it or not, this whole, you know, this whole idea of the value of organizing, community organizing, organizing poor people is, you know, is important. It's back in vogue, as we see with Obama. So I think that the farm workers set the stage.
Yes, Obama gave community organizing a good name, didn't he?
Yeah.
Well, it was also during the campaign, it was sort of also a critical term. You know, the people on Fox News said, well, he was an organizer, as if that meant sort of evil, suspicious person. And, you know, the best people I know are organizers.
Yeah.
They do the most. They contribute the most.
Yes. Well, of course, I remember so vividly Sarah Palin in her first major address after she was nominated to be vice president, how she made fun of and mocked the fact that Obama had been a community organizer. And little did she know.
But, you know, but I mean, but that's another reason to tell this story, because it's not just her. I'd venture that most people in the United States, unless they've had direct contact with organizers, don't understand how important that process is. You know, I think organizing isn't very well appreciated. You know, it's growing now, obviously. Obama helped, you know, lots of successful campaigns are going now. It's growing, but, you know, but organizers are pretty much unsung heroes. You know, they don't do it for respect, they do it for results. And they don't, in general, they don't talk about what they did, you know. They don't promote themselves, they just do it. So, you know, that was a great part of the story to be able to show.
Well, Rick, I want to push on with you for a minute in terms of what conclusions or observations do you have in looking at the bigger picture of the farm worker movement, having worked on it for so many years. What do you think?
Well, you know, it's interesting because since I had been part of the movement for a while, I ended up with a starting position that, oh, I know what happened, right? And so it was really great to find out what really happened, you know, and some of it fit with my preconceptions and some didn't. And for example, you know, there's this feeling, you know, something great happened in Delano in 1965, the great strike began. And, you know, that's the conventional wisdom, but, you know, it was quite remarkable for me to uncover the early story that, you know, that the grape strike came from a long period of organizing, that came from CSO, that came from looking at failed models of organizing in the past. So it's really quite, you know, that sort of made me understand that the farm workers was a successful moment, but it was a moment in a long continuum, you know, that many things had led up to it, and, you know, and it leads to many other things, you know, as opposed to just being this moment, all, you know, this inexplicable moment, you know, the issue, you know, of why did it work and what was it that made it work, you know, and where did they learn how to do that? That was, you know, getting a clear vision of that was really impressive, you know, because I'm not an organizer either, so organizing was pretty, you know, I knew it worked, but I didn't know how it worked as well, because I never had to deal with it, so that was, you know, a very important set of revelations for me to really get it. Get it in a larger context.
Ray, do you have anything to add to that?
No, I think just to add a little bit to Rick's thoughts that, you know, this history of labor organizing is a continuum that started way, way before Caesar. If you look at, and we were able to explore the history of labor organizing from the turn of the century, the 19th and the 20th century. But then looking back at the ups and downs of labor in general and the ups and downs of the farm workers, seen where we are right now in terms of community and labor organizing in 2009, almost 2010, I have a better appreciation for the work that was done, given the Obama administration and the impact of organizing in many, many different aspects of our country. So I think the farm workers were an important part of that, but it's a continuum mm-hmm. that's, this process has gone on for, over mm-hmm. 100 years.
And still continues, as you say, into with the ups and downs of the modern day labor movements,
I mean, it practically wiped out during Reagan, and now they're making a comeback. So
Right.
See, the other important lesson that was really driven home to me by doing the film and thinking about it was, farmers didn't have a model. They said this works, we'll do more with it. This doesn't work, we'll switch gears. And that's, I think, one of the crucial lessons, because people are organizing in a different way today than they were organizing 30, 40 years ago. They're saying, okay, this is the world. How do we respond to this? And that was something that the farm workers, they were not rigid. They didn't say, this is the way you organize. They said, let's try this. Let's try the boycott. Let's try different ways of doing it. And, that model of responding, I think, is very important. It's, mm-hmm. People are looking for new ways to respond today.
I wonder, one of the things that has struck me looking back on the farm worker movement, which I find rather mind-boggling myself, is how much trust, how much authority, how much responsibility was invested in very, very young people. I'm talking about 18, 19, 20, 21-year-old people. It's hard to believe now, as an old man, looking back, that so much was entrusted to so many who were young.
Well, I think that talks, addresses the fact that you have people who really were true believers, who were passionate about what they believed in, and did good things for the right reasons. And I think I look at this past election and who are the folks who were kind of leading the charge in terms of raising money and organizing for Obama, the youngsters.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we underestimate the 18, 19, 20 year olds, and they're the ones that have a lot of energy and kind of a real, real clear sense of purpose. Maybe not always, but in this case, I think they did. They trusted their guts and they went with it.
But how did they know what to do?
Well, I don't think they always did the right
thing. They didn't.
They didn't. They kind of... Go ahead.
Well, I think there were some false steps, but the issue is... The issue is these were people who had enough energy, sort of depressing statement. When I worked for the farm workers, there were victory parties, but there were a lot of defeat parties. The idea when you were defeated is, okay, we'll have the party next time, we'll go back to work. Let's try it again. They didn't give up.
And
that's really part of it. But
right. No, it was. I didn't want to get off on a side issue there, but it's just something that has been dawning on me as of late, how young people were at that, and accomplished so much, and as Rick said, made a lot of false starts along the way,
right.
But kept at it. I'd like to go now to what about the future of filmmaking with respect to Cesar Chavez and the farm worker movement? I mean, where do you think that stands? Is there a future, do you think, for that, or no? Rick, what about, why don't you
start?
Well,
part of the issue is, I think the time is not right on us, but is approaching where you will not be able to do first-person history anymore. And first-person history is always better history than you know, I mean, my aunt was a scholar, and she dealt with 17th century Mexico, and she can't interview anyone who went through 17th century Mexico. So I'm sure there are lots of other films to be made, and you know, it's an important subject, and people will deal with it and look at aspects that we didn't cover or other films haven't covered. But, you know, but 20 years from now, it's going to be very hard. You know, some of these people will not even be alive, and if they are, their memories won't be as clear. So it'll be much harder to do the kind of film that we did. You know, I think other kinds of films can be made about the farm workers and should. You know, that, you know, even though we were trying to be exhaustive, you know, there was only so far we could go. You know, and other people say, well, this is great, we like that, but let's look at this area. You know, for example, we have a young friend who is exploring in depth the Filipino story. You know, and that's an important story, and it's something that we mentioned and looked at, but we didn't go into in depth. So, you know, there are all these other things that are worthwhile that filmmakers are going to continue to work with, I'm sure.
Ray?
Yeah, I agree with Rick. I mean, there's other stories out there, and also, you know, I think this is the time to do these stories while people who participated actively are alive and articulate. But I also think I encourage anybody who's going to go down this road that they do good research and good scholarship, because there's a lot of myths out there, and a lot of folks who have you know, little information about who Caesar was and what the farm workers are about, but they have very little contact with anybody who participated. And, you know, I've heard of a couple of films that are out there being developed that I just think, you know, if they don't do the research, they're going to miss the mark. So I think, you know, good research, good scholarship is real important to making these historical films. You got to get it right.
Mm-hmm. And the other issue, you know, it's specifically switching gears from, say, making films to scholarship and scholarly writing, is, you know, one of the interesting things we found out was we assembled a team of scholars, and then we looked at the literature, and there had been a lot of very good journalistic reports of the farm workers. There had been almost no scholarly work. So, you know, that's a huge field. It was like a black hole. Even though it was so important, people hadn't concentrated on it. You know, we had great scholars who brought other perspectives to bear on it, but, you know, I think only one of the scholars had actually written about Caesar extensively. So I think that's really going to grow in the next generation.
You know, you mentioned in passing, Rick, I guess it was Rick, about the Filipino story. What I've noticed over the last 3 years, specifically, is there's more and more interest. I think coming primarily from Filipino academics and others, in the filmmaking business, for example, who want to open up that story and tell it and tell more about it, because it's such a sad, sad chapter in the history of our country, and it's never really been told.
Well, and that's a good example of setting the record straight, because the conventional wisdom is that Caesar started the strike, and we all know, if you look at the story, that the Caesar's movement, the National Farm Workers Association, joined the strike that had been started by the Filipinos. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so it's important to say what really happened.
Yeah.
Right.
But there is a film. I mean, it's a film in the works right now by Melissa Roy, a Filipino filmmaker here from the Bay Area, that I'm hoping that, you know, she gets the funding to do, and she's totally capable of doing this film. It's a really, really important part of American history. That's
right. Does she have a working title? Do you know, Ray?
Boy, no, I don't know what it is.
Okay.
Marisa Arroy.
Marisa Arroy. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. And well, I think if we could sort of summarize and wrap up the interview. I think you've touched on this question, but let's just end with it, and that is, if you were asked by a young filmmaker who wanted to make a film about Cesar Chavez and his farmworker movement, what advice would you give him? Each of you give him or her about that. Ray, what about you?
That's a good question. I would suggest that, you know, that they, you know, take a look and at what's out there, what's been written, and you know, and what stories have been, you know, whatever stories they can find that have been done, and take a look at the fighting fields, and then go out and talk to some of the folks who are actually participating, you know, farm workers as well as, you know, some of the leaders, just try to get a sense of what you know, how they see themselves now, you know, how they, you know, talk to Dolores, talk to you, talk to Artie, and ask them about, you know, their history and their involvement and how you folks all got involved and how you see the, you know, farm workers movement and labor organizing today. And I think you'll come up with a different, you know, there'll be some similarities, but they'll come up maybe with some different film than the film we came up with. But I think you have to do some studying and talk to the folks.
And Rick?
Well, the bottom line is in filmmaking is you cannot tell a story you don't understand. So,
yeah.
plunging in means doing your homework, means spending time with people. It means, you know, someone comes up to me that I don't know and asks me all about stuff, I'll tell them a certain amount. But if I spend more time with them, I'll think of other things. I'll feel more comfortable with them. So you really have to commit to, you know, it's almost like Caesar said about organizing. You have to commit to relationships, you know.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not saying everyone I talk to is a great friend of mine, but, you know, but we had relationships, and that was, you know, if you do that, you get really wonderful material.
Right. Yeah. And one thing I think that Rick and I mentioned is that in order to even move ahead with the film is that we had to deal with the foundation for a period over, what, a year, year and a half, Rick?
Foundation.
In terms of developing relationship. Pardon me?
What foundation?
The Farm Workers Foundation, in terms of us having access to any of the archival material.
Oh, you mean the Cesar Chavez Foundation?
The Cesar Chavez Foundation, We would.
Oh, okay.
Until we got the buyout from them, we could not move forward with the film.
Well, we weren't even going to. You could make an unauthorized biography.
Yeah.
We didn't want to do that. But, you know, but that's the same principle holds true, you know.
Yeah.
We had to develop those relationships. You know, we had, you know, there's no reason the UFW or the Service Center, you know, they have to be selective about why they would cooperate with someone. You know, they have to be convinced that you're going to tell a true story and you're going to treat things fairly. And, you know, so that's another set of relationships that, you know, a lot of people, not in the farm workers movement only, but perhaps there too, is they have this profound suspicion of the media, and it's justified, you know, because of this pattern of people coming in, doing stories they don't understand, and then saying, oh, here's a critical thing, that'll be interesting, let's focus on that, you know, so you have to convince people you're not coming in to do a hit piece, you know, and that takes a while.
That's a very good point.
Because when I do a film, I always try and spend time with the people whenever possible first, so that they get a sense of who I am as well as me, you know, getting a better sense of them.
All
right. Well, with that, I would like to bring the interview to a close, and I would like to thank our guests today, Ray Tejas and Rick Tejada Flores. It's been a real privilege for me to sit on this side of the interview instead of sitting on the other side of the interview. And I appreciate your willingness to do this, and thank you very much.
Thank you, Ivory.
Well, we wouldn't have done it if we didn't trust you. This is the same thing.
We don't care for just anybody.
Yeah.
We'll bring the interview to a close. Thank you.
Thank you very much. All right.
Bye-bye.